showing a ship that was, they say, hijacked.
U.S. military has carried out strikes on multiple Houthi targets in Yemen.
Welcome to episode 36 of Tahrir Podcast and the first episode in 2024. It is the 15th of February and this episode is about Yemen's Houthis. Beginning on the 19th of October 2023, Yemen's Houthi rebels started firing missiles and drones towards Israel in protest of Israel's aggression in Gaza. Most missiles and drones fired have either been intercepted or landed in either Egypt or Jordan. They also staged multiple seizures of civilian-operated cargo ships sailing near the Yemeni coast and have claimed any Israel-linked shipping vessel as a target, although multiple vessels with no apparent link to Israel have also been attacked. Today I'm joined by Nedwa Al-Dosari to talk about the situation. Al-Dosari is a researcher and a conflict practitioner with over 20 years of field experience in Yemen, where she worked with tribes, civil society, local authorities, security actors, and non-state armed groups. Nedwa is currently a non-resident scholar with the Middle East Institute and a fellow at the Center on Armed Groups. Previously, she was a non-resident senior fellow of the Project on Middle East Democracy, a Yemen country director for the Center for Civilians in Conflict, and a founding director for Partners Yemen. Earlier in her career, she worked with the National Democratic Institute. Today, she joins me from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Nedwa.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So before we get into the details about the Houthis' most recent attacks and the situation unfolding as we speak, could you maybe start by giving a brief background on the Yemeni civil war and how the Houthis have made it to the position where they are today?
Yes. So I assume we're talking about the civil war since 2014, because Yemen has different dimensions of conflicts and they overlap and they reinforce each other. But in 2014, the Houthi rebels captured the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, and toppled the government and then started expanding militarily across Yemen. With support from former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was removed from power or forced to step down from power in 2011 after the youth uprising during the Arab Spring. So the Houthis then expanded across the north, like I said, and they attempted to expand to the south into Aden. And that's when the Saudi-led coalition intervened based on a request by former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, and with the objective of ending the Houthis' coup and reinstating the Yemeni government into the seat of power in Sana'a.
In your most recent article for the Middle East Institute titled "The Ideological Underpinnings of the Houthis' Red Sea Attacks," you mentioned that the Houthis' political ambitions are rooted in Zaydism. So could you explain more about the historical context of Zaydism and its influence on the Houthis?
Yes. So the Houthis are largely perceived by many Yemenis as an extension of the Imamate. The Imamate was a theocracy that ruled Yemen for hundreds of years until it was overthrown in 1962. The Imamate, or the Imams, were descendants of the Prophet, and that's where they drew their divine right to rule. But the Houthis are not exactly you can't just say the Houthis are Zaydis. The Houthis are Jarudi Zaydis. Now, Jarudi Zaydis are the most strict subsect of Zaydi Islam, Zaydi Shia Islam. And Jarudis claim that only Ahlul Bayt, or, you know, Prophet Muhammad's descendants, have an exclusive and divine right to rule the Muslim nation. But unlike other Zaydis, Jarudis elevate imams to a prophet status, and they believe that their imam is chosen by God and that his authority is absolute and cannot be challenged by a human being as such. Now, other Zaydi sects were more sort of flexible and moderate in that sense, not Jarudis. So the Houthis refer to their founder, Hussein al-Houthi, as the talking Quran, okay, or the martyr of the Quran. And their current leader, they refer to him as the leader of the Quranic march, and that's the term that the Houthis use to describe their political and religious platform. And Houthis family claim a divine right to rule by virtue of being, or by virtue of being descendants of Prophet Muhammad's bloodline. And this is what a lot of people don't understand about, you know, the Houthis, and they tend to conflate the Houthis with the Zaydi revivalist movement, which unfortunately informed a lot of the analysis, especially among Western analysts, who sort of, to a large extent, romanticized with the Houthis. I don't know if you want me to give a little background about the Zaydi revivalist movement and how the Houthis came to that movement and how that evolved into the rebellion. I can do that.
Sure, please do.
Yes. So back in the 80s, in the mid to late 80s, a group of Zaydi scholars created the Zaydi revivalist movement, or the youth believers, Shabab al-Mu'min. And the purpose of that movement was to counter the spread of Salafi Islam, which it was brought to that part of the country, Sada, which is the seat of the Zaydi Imamate. It was brought by some Salafi scholars who came back from Saudi Arabia, and they started studying circles and they started spreading Sunni Islam, which was very critical of the Zaydi culture and the Zaydi religion. And that sort of, made these Zaydi scholars start a movement to counter the Salafi influence. But the Zaydi revivalist movement, or the Muslim, believing youth or youth believers, was a movement of reformists. Now, Hussein al-Houthi, who was the founder of the Houthi rebellion, was not part of that Zaydi movement. His brother was, but he was not the main actor. The main actors were Muhammad Azzan, Abdul Karim Jadban, Ali Razhi, Saleh Habran. All these guys are tribal guys. They're Zaydi scholars, but they came from tribes. They didn't come from Hashemite family. Hashemite means descendants of it's the local term Yemenis used to refer to Yemenis who claim descendants from Prophet Muhammad, Hashemite or Sayyids. Now, Muhammad al-Houthi, who was Hussein's brother, was part of that group, but he was not very active in the group. And the purpose of the movement was basically to preserve the Zaydi tradition and also to encourage youth, to empower them, and to help them be more open and more knowledgeable. It was not a political movement. It was more a cultural sort of social movement. But then in 1990, when the unification happened and Yemen adopted democracy, a lot of Zaydi scholars came together and they created Hizb al-Haq, al-Haq political party, which became sort of the Zaydi / Hashemite sort of political body. And Hussein al-Houthi became a member of parliament on behalf of that party in 1993, which was the first elections in Yemen. And so moving forwards, there was a serious disagreement between the founders of the Believing Youth and also Hussein al-Houthi's group. Inside Hizb al-Haq itself, there was a major disagreement about one important thing, with one group of members who are Zaydi scholars, who said that the imamate, which is being descendants of the prophet, is an outdated condition. It should not be a condition for somebody to rule. And then the other half, which includes the father of Hussein al-Houthi and Hussein al-Houthi, insisted that that condition should remain. So there was a split within al-Haqqa party. And that split sort of translated into the Believing Youth movement, the leadership. By the by the mid-1990s, Hussein al-Houthi, who was a member of parliament then, he was not really active in the Believing Youth movement. He gave lectures sometimes, but then he started trying to influence the movement with his brother, and then there was a split. His brother and himself and his father were one camp, and then the original founders who mainly came from tribal background, who were Zaydi scholars, not political, were on another camp. So long story short, what happened in the late 90s is that Hussein al-Houthi hijacked the movement, militarized it, and then in 2001 he came up with his slogan, Death to America, Death to Israel, curse the Jews, victory to Islam. And then in 2004, he picked up arms against the government. But also it's very important to say that Hussein al-Houthi and his father were extremely influenced by the Iranian revolution. They both spent time in Iran in the mid-80s and in the 90s. Hussein al-Houthi and also the current leader, Abdelmalek al-Houthi, spent time in Lebanon and Iran. Hussein al-Houthi was committed to importing the Iranian revolution to Yemen, and that sort of influenced the direction of the movement, especially, you know, the anti-West and anti-America, language.
In your analysis, you highlight the alignment of the Houthis with Iran's axis of resistance. How has Iran influenced the ideology and actions of the Houthis, especially that they both subscribe to different Shia sects?
They do subscribe to different Shia sects. So Iran and the Houthis benefited from each other. They're strong allies. They have the same objectives in the region, which is to push the U.S. and the West out of the region, take Mecca, and then destroy Israel and take Jerusalem. And then from there, establish an Islamic state. The Houthis benefited a lot from Iran in terms of training, military training, weapons, advisory. There are hundreds of Hezbollah and IRGC commanders on the ground helping the Houthis. It's been the case even since before the war started. Helping them with military strategizing, with propaganda, with messaging, with controlling the population, coming up with ways to control the population. If you see the Houthis sort of ruling system, the system that created since 2014, it's very similar to what the IRGC did in Iran after the Iranian revolution. So a lot of expertise came to the Houthis from Iran. In addition, Iran also donated a lot of oil to the Houthis, which the Houthis sold in the black market for tons of money. And so, and Iran has gained from the Houthis the plausible deniability. So Iran would help the Houthis with weapons and equipment and training and strategizing. And the Houthis, like now in the Red Sea, the Houthis are attacking ships with the help of Iranian commanders on the ground, and intelligence from Behzad, which is the Iranian ship that is sitting now off the Chinese base in Djibouti, and before then it was in the Red Sea, and then the Bab al-Mandab, near Bab al-Mandab. But Iran can deny, because there's no proof that Iran is providing the Houthis with this kind of help. So they complement each other, and they what the Iran does, what the Houthis are doing, is advancing their goal in the region.
In the article, you also mentioned the establishment of a theocratic police state by the Houthis. So how does this influence their leadership structure, and how do they legitimize their authority?
So the Houthis have inherited the government bureaucracy. They control, as soon as they took Sana'a in 2014, they controlled ministries, they captured military bases. A lot of the employees in the government now work for the Houthis, because that was their job before. But they rule the country through a shadow system and a jihadist council. That shadow, the jihadist council is led by Abdelmalek al-Houthi himself. and his aides are Iranian and Hezbollah advisors. But then also they have on the ground at every ministry, every school, every neighborhood, and every village, they have the, every police station, every court, they have what they call supervisors. So there's this network of supervisors that rule over these institutions. And these supervisors are, they're ideologues. They come from Abdelmalek al-Houthi's inner circle, and they're empowered. They have authorities over ministers, over governors, over heads of police stations, you name it. And the Houthis' system of governance, I don't know if it's right to call it system of governance, but let me just use the word governance here, which doesn't mean providing services to the people, but it means the way they function as a ruler. It relies on controlling the population rather than providing services. So it's a highly repressive system. It's repressive, particularly to women, journalists, civil society, but Yemenis in general. And so, but also Yemen in the north, and that's a really very important angle. So North Yemen has always had very strong tribes, and the Houthis have been systematically trying to dismantle the tribal structure and subjugate the tribes. So in the past, the tribes used to be like partners with the state. Now the Houthis have relegated the tribe to a subordinate status, and the purpose is to relegate the tribes to basically pools of recruits. That's where they get most of their fighters, and they can recruit fighters when the tribes are weaker, and that's what the Houthis have been working on. So, they have all kind of rules. So one of the rules that they've created is a code of conduct for government employees. And basically that code of conduct, it was signed a couple of years ago. And in that code of conduct, all government employees had to sign on that code of conduct, have to unconditionally support the Houthis leadership. Anybody who is critical of the Houthis is accused of being a spy with Americans and Israelis, even before the U.S. intervened to with airstrikes recently. This was the case. This was an accusation that's always there that the Houthis used to threaten and eliminate their opponents. The Houthis have thousands of Yemenis in their secret prisons that are being tortured. They have tortured hundreds to death, women, including women and children as well. They did the first public execution of a dozen Yemeni civilians a couple of years ago. And that was meant to intimidate people and opponents. And so it's intimidation, it's repression, it's cruelty, and it's basically a system. I like to compare it to like North Korea, because it's a system where you have to have absolute support to the ruler, which is Abdelmalek al-Houthi now, and in return you are not allowed to demand services. So people who protested for salaries, teachers protested because they wanted salaries. Even young men and women who even remotely criticized the Houthis on social media, they were abducted, they were disappeared. Last year, during the 26th September, the anniversary for the 26th September revolution, which overthrew the Imamate in 1962. Last year, thousands took to the streets to celebrate the revolution. It was a statement against the Houthis because people believed that the Houthis want to reinstate the Imamate. But then the Houthis rounded up thousands of these people and they threw them in jail. So this is a system of basically the system that uses terror to subjugate the population, and at the same time claim that it has a right to do what it does because it speaks on behalf of God.
In the article, you also mention a religious prophecy involving the Mahdi. So how do the Houthis interpret this prophecy, and how does it impact their strategic decisions, particularly in the Red Sea?
Well, I mean, it's not just the Houthis who believe in this. I think all Islamist groups do. It's Shia and Sunnis. This is the one thing that unifies Shia and Sunnis. So Muslim scholars in general on all sides believe that near the end of time, a figure will emerge. That Prophet Muhammad told his companions that near the end of time, a figure will emerge, and he will be from his own bloodline. There are variations to the stories, but this is basically the main frame. And that figure will emerge, and he will create an army, and he will liberate Jerusalem and prepare for Jesus' return. And that figure, his name is Al-Mahdi, or his title is Al-Mahdi. That figure will fill earth with justice, just like it used to be filled before him with injustice or injustice. And so that belief is actually among Muslims. It's one of the requirements for Muslims to believe in. Every Muslim is supposed to believe that this is going to happen in the end of days. But the Houthis are acting on it because they believe that they can bring that end. Now, whether Abdelmalek al-Houthi thinking that he is al-Mahdi or that he is the person who will prepare for al-Mahdi come back, we don't know. But religious scholars says that what happens before al-Mahdi's come back is revolutions in Yemen, in Iraq, and in the Sham, which is the Levant region. And so that unifies the Houthis with the axis of resistance. The Iranians also believe that the revolution was a sign. The Houthis believe that revolution was a sign because the story goes that Prophet Muhammad told his companions that a man will also start a revolution in Yemen, particularly in Sana'a, in preparation for al-Mahdi's comeback. And so all these armies will come together, and then al-Mahdi will receive an oath of allegiance from his followers in Mecca, and then he will march towards Jerusalem, and then he will liberate Jerusalem, and then establish an Islamic state. And then from there, he will capture Constantinople, which is Istanbul, and Rome. And some scholars said Rome, when the Prophet said Rome, it's probably modern day Europe, because there's no Rome anymore, like the empire. So that is the prophecy that Prophet Muhammad told his companions, and that Muslim scholars across the aisle believe in. And I believe that's what drives the Houthis. And I don't believe that because I'm just guessing. It's very strongly present in their documents, in their discourse, in the teachings that they give to their followers, that they force, on children in these indoctrination centers that they send children to every summer. And so, and unfortunately, most analysts dismiss this ideological component of the Houthis when I believe that it is the main driver. Because what happens is that this belief, this prophecy, and believing that it will come true, and believing that the Houthis are the ones who are going to make it true, it gives the group such confidence, which is something that they've demonstrated since the beginning of the conflict.
given the recent US-UK airstrikes and the Houthi response, how do you interpret their confidence, strategic patience, and tendency to escalate and contest the West's approach?
Well, two things. The Houthis are confident because they feel that they won the war. That's one thing. So they feel they've defeated the Saudi-led coalition. I mean, at the end, they bombed Saudi for years, including Aramco, and that forced the Saudis to come to them and literally beg them to accept a solution, to accept a settlement, to accept a deal that they will only benefit from at the expense of the Yemeni government and other Yemeni parties. And two, again, they're on by that prophecy that God is on their side. They've gotten this far in their mind, and they say that. They've gotten this far because God has helped them make it, because God has a plan for them. And the plan is not just winning the war in Yemen. And so their confidence can be explained by how other actors in the conflict failed to defeat them during the war, but also by a belief that God has a long-term plan for them, and this is just one piece of the story.
And how do you perceive the impact of Saudi airstrikes in comparison to the most recent US-UK airstrikes? Are there significant differences or similarities in their approaches and consequences? Because both seem to have not reached any of their goals.
Well, when the Saudi airstrikes went on for years and they've caused so many civilian casualties and destruction in civilian infrastructure. Now, when it comes to U.S. airstrikes, the precision is excellent. There hasn't been any civilian casualties or civilian infrastructure damage. Having said that, it is the same short-term approach. The Saudis thought they can defeat the Houthis through airstrikes, through mainly relying on airstrikes, which is what the Saudis did, and that failed. And now the U.S. also believes that they can neutralize the Houthi threat through airstrikes, which is short-sighted. Even if the U.S. airstrikes end up completely dismantling the Houthis' missile capabilities, that is not going to neutralize the Houthi threats. One, because the Houthis can find ways to attack Red Sea shipping or to undermine Red Sea shipping by other means. They probably have already stashed a lot of their weapons before their strikes because they had a lot of advance notice. Three, the geography is on their side in that sense. But at the same time, and more importantly, and this is what people don't pay attention to because they like to look at the technical side of it. You know, how many missile launchers are we going to destroy? How many, you know, missiles are we going to intercept? But the thing is that the Houthis sit on 70% of the population, and 75% of that population are young people under 25 years old or 29 years old, half of them at least under 14 years old. And so the Houthis are sitting on a lot of capability that the U.S. cannot neutralize. So what the Houthis have been doing, they have been systematically indoctrinating children and young people. They have made almost 500 changes to the school curriculum to instill their sectarian ideology, which is anti-West, anti-U.S., anti-democracy, anti-freedoms, unconditional obedience to the ruler, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, there is a lot of poverty. I mean, two-thirds of the Yemeni population are struggling to put food on the table, and that will only be exacerbated with the continuation of the conflict and the airstrikes. And the Houthis are counting on it because the Houthis want to, one, isolate the Yemeni population, which they've done over the past 10 years. And then, you know, an isolated, poor population is easy to recruit. the UN says that at least 2.5 children have dropped out of school because people cannot afford education anymore, because education facilities and the education sector was severely damaged by the conflict. Teachers have not received salaries since 2016. And that's a good news for the Houthis, because a child that does not go to school is a child that's easier to recruit. So in my opinion, the U.S. is playing into the hands of the Houthis. This is what the Houthis wanted. They wanted the airstrikes. They invited the airstrikes. Part of what they do in the Red Sea is about Gaza, not necessarily because they care about Gaza people, but, well, Jerusalem is very important to the Houthis. But a big part of it is because they wanted to drag the U.S. into a war in Yemen. Because, well, again, that helps them. That will enable them to control the population even more. Because now, if you don't support the Houthis, then you are a Zionist. If you are critical of what the Houthis are doing, you're a Zionist. Even if you don't say anything about the Red Sea, you are a Zionist. That's the accusation now. And at the same time, you invite the U.S. to the region, and the Houthis know that the U.S. does not want to be dragged into a conflict in the region, and so does Iran. And so they're counting on the U.S. being, you know, short-sighted and being reactionary, getting fatigued in the region and just leave. But also, the Houthis, what are they doing also? And that's where they really did a good job of exploiting the Gaza war to help their narrative. The Houthis are posing themselves as the defenders of Palestine, and for that they have earned a lot of popularity in the Arab world, in the Western world, and to some extent within Yemen. But what the Houthis are doing now is creating anti-West and anti-US sentiment that did not exist before in the country. And some of it is, justifiable, because the U.S. did not do anything to stop, you know, what's happening in Gaza, the massacres, the tragedy in Gaza. But at the same time, the Houthis are using that to boost their popularity within Yemen. And a lot of Yemenis support what the Houthis do in the Red Sea. Not the Houthis themselves, but the actions that the Houthis are doing. And that is because the Palestinian cause is very, very dear and important to Arabs, all Arabs. And so for many, the Houthis are the only people or the only group that rose to the challenge and tried to hold Israel accountable. And so you see how they're benefiting from different things, and while still at the same time, they're focused on their long-term goal. You know, drag the U.S. into a war of attrition, which will force the U.S. out. After all, we've seen that in Afghanistan, right? 20 years after the war in Afghanistan, and the U.S. withdrew, basically handing Yemen over to Taliban on a silver plate. And so that is also another driver for Houthis' confidence. They know their enemy, and they know they're short-sighted. And they know their enemies do not have the strategic patience they have.
And is there a guarantee that Red Sea attacks will cease if Israel halts its aggression on Gaza?
I think the Houthis will stop Red Sea attacks if the Gaza war stops, but I think that will only be temporarily. The Houthis are a threat to the Red Sea. They will continue to be a threat to the Red Sea. I think what they're going to do after that, they will focus on escalating within Yemen to capture the whole country, and then they will obstruct shipping in the Red Sea for one reason or another, whether it's extorting the West, or then find another reason to attack ships or block the shipping in the Red Sea. So as long as they stay in power, as long as they stay militarily strong, the Houthis will continue to be a threat. And the Red Sea will continue to be a hostage to the Houthis.
And how do you think that cycle could be broken?
I've said that before. It's not a very popular opinion. But the only way to mitigate the Houthi threat or to neutralize it is to weaken them militarily. And I think the West need to learn from its past mistakes. In 2018, Yemeni government forces, with support from the Saudi-led coalition, were about to take the Hodeidah seaport. They were only 3 kilometers away from the seaport. The Houthi leader himself announced on TV that his forces would withdraw tactically, which was basically withdrawal, okay? But, you know, he had to save face by saying tactically. And the international community, the UN, the US, the UK, pressured the Saudi-led coalition and the Yemeni government to abort the operation. And they did, against warnings. We, as Yemenis, warned about this. The Saudi-led coalition warned about that. The Yemeni government warned about that, that this will enable the Houthis to regroup. And keeping control of the seaports will only make them a threat to international shipping in the future. We said that in before December 2018. But the U.S. and the international community simply ignored that warning. And they called the Stockholm Agreement a success towards peace in Yemen, which was laughable. And by the way, that agreement was never implemented because the Houthis refused to implement it. And so now the Houthis are you know, as predicted, are threatening international shipping. And so now the U.S. is relying on airstrikes, but airstrikes will help the Houthis because it reinforced their narrative that they're at war with the U.S. and Israel, and it will help them further subjugate the population and isolate them and recruit more fighters. I mean, just the other day or yesterday, the Houthi government spokesman said they've recruited 200,000 fighters, more than 200,000 fighters since October 7th. And so if the Houthis are not weakened militarily, there is no way to neutralize them. What happened after the Stockholm Agreement in 2018 was that Houthis regrouped, and then they made massive military gains. They took control of large territory. They took control of the rest of Sana'a governorate. They took control of Bayda, Jowf, and they took control of 12 of the 14 districts of Marib, and now they're practically engulfing Marib City, which is the last stronghold of the government in the north, where 3 million people live. Most of them are IDPs. And that's because the UN decided, well, we need to stop the Hodeidah liberation operation. And so this short-sightedness is just the pattern among the UN and the West in general. It continues to be the case with these airstrikes. The US think they can neutralize the Houthi threats with airstrikes, and that's just wishful thinking. The alternative is to support Yemeni forces who are on the ground to weaken the Houthis militarily. And people say, yeah, they have divisions among them. These forces are not exactly united. Well, that is true, but they're all united against the Houthis. They all want the Houthis weakened. But I don't have confidence that the international community will hear this again, because they're always reactionary and short-sighted. My concern is that the Houthis will benefit from these airstrikes to recruit more people, to isolate the Yemeni population, and then in the later stage to expand militarily and take all Yemen. And then they will threaten Red Sea shipping again. And what's going to happen then? Now there would be no more forces on the ground to help push the Houthis. What's going to happen? The West is going to decide to invade Yemen? Or, you know, the West is going to decide, well, the Red Sea is a lost cause, and we have to find other ways for international shipping, and that, you know, for Yemen, for Egypt, for all countries in that region, that's a disaster. That's an economic disaster. And Egypt is already suffering because of the Red Sea shipping. And so, you know, the West is always two steps behind, and the Houthis and Iran are always one step ahead. And so, you know, that is why they've always prevailed since the beginning of this war.
Mm. And how does the Houthis' anti-imperialist agenda resonate globally? And don't you think it's quite ironic that their anti-imperialist agenda earned them growing support, especially among far-left groups in the West, despite one of their underlying goals being to establish their version of Islamist imperialism?
Yeah, it is ironic, but the far-left are not driven by, you know, caring about Yemen or the Yemeni population or civilian casualties. The far-left are driven by their own domestic agenda, which is they don't want the U.S. to engage in any war. They don't want the U.S. to support the Saudis. They don't want the U.S. to sell arms to groups or governments that fight other governments. So that is the lens they see Yemen conflict through. And so they don't want to see, they don't want to hear other narratives. They don't want to, they've romanticized with the Houthis. Even before the Gaza war started, they've been romanticizing for the Houthis. They've actively advocated for the Houthis in the West. But of course, they said they were advocating for peace in Yemen. And that's not a surprise. You know, it's unfortunate because if the Houthis take Yemen, not only that will undermine security in the region, but that would be a threat to the entire world, given their agenda, their long-term goal, which is taking Jerusalem and establishing an Islamic state. And it's hard for people in the West, and I've talked to my Western friends, and they don't really understand it. They're like, this is so hard for us to understand because they think with their secular mentalities. But the Houthis are not secular. And you know, people like you and I who come from countries that are majority Muslims know how ideology is so embedded in people's thinking and how it drives their actions, especially groups that have gained so much power, military power, and prominence over a short period of time, which is like the past decade. So I think the world will come to regret this. If the world does not address the Houthi threat now in a more sustainable way, in a more long-term way, the world would come to regret it at some point.
Definitely. Any closing remarks?
I do encourage people to try to understand the Houthi's ideology more, to try to dive deep into that. But also I want to say that Yemen is not too far from here. I mean, the U.S. Yemen is not too far from the U.S. Yemen is not too far from Europe. When the conflict started in Saada in 2004, we Yemenis thought it was too far. It was just in the far north, in the far remote mountains of Saada. We had no idea. No Yemenis saw this coming. Not even in 2013 and the beginning of 2014. We did not see the Houthis coming. And they came. And even when they took Sana'a, we did not think that they would continue to control the capital. And look at them now. When the Houthis showed pictures and videos of their drones in 2016, we were laughing at them. We ridiculed them. And a couple of years later, they started attacking Saudi Arabia with missiles and drones, inflicting so much damage on the kingdom, its own pride, you know. Above all, nobody saw that coming. When the West decided that they will force the Yemeni government to stop the retaking of Hodeidah operation from the Houthis, they did not see the Red Sea attacks coming. So what else do we need to see coming for the West and for the international community to look at the Houthis as the threat they are and to try to address that looking long-term, not using tactical interventions like airstrikes. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me, Nadwa.
Shukran. Bye-bye.